Hey all, this is Chris from Inklings Variety Hour. I just wanted to say that we do have an Instagram now. Please feel free to follow us at Inklings Variety Hour, all one word. However tired you are, it takes some nerve to walk up to a giant's front door. In spite of all his previous warnings against Harfang, it was Puddleglum who showed the most courage. "Steady pace now," he said. "Don't look frightened, whatever you do. We've done the silliest thing in the world by coming at all. But now that we are here, we best put a bold face on it." With these words, he strode forward into the gateway, stood still under the arch where the echo would help his voice, and called out as loud as he could, "Ho, porter! Guests who seek lodging!" And while he was waiting for something to happen, he took off his hat and knocked off the heavy mass of snow which had gathered on its wide brim. "I say," whispered Scrub to Jill, "he may be a wet blanket, but he has plenty of pluck and cheek." A door opened, letting out a delicious glow of firelight, and the porter appeared. Jill bit her lips for fear she should scream. He was not a perfectly enormous giant, that is to say, he was rather taller than an apple tree, but nothing like so tall as a telegraph pole. He had bristly red hair, a leather jerkin with metal plates fastened all over it so as to make a kind of mail shirt, bare knees, very hairy indeed, and things like putties on his legs. He stooped down and goggled at Puddleglum. "And what sort of creature do you call yourself?" he said. Jill took her courage in both hands. "Please," she said, shouting up to the giant. "The Lady of the Green Kirtle salutes the King of the Gentle Giants and has sent us two southern children and this marsh wiggle, his name's Puddleglum, to your autumn feast. If it's quite convenient, of course," she added.
"I was pointing out last time that the Christian life is simply a process of having your natural self changed into a Christ self."
Welcome to the Inklings Variety Hour, where fans and scholars of C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, Charles Williams, Owen Barfield, and others discuss their works and lives. I'm Chris Pipkin, not so tall as a telegraph pole, but endowed with both pluck and cheek. And with me today, I have friend of the show, Eric Geddes, out in Arizona. How you doing, Eric?
Oh, good. Hi, everybody.
Good. Good to have you again. Also with me, I have author, blogger, and teacher, Jonathan Geltner. How's it going, Jonathan?
I'm doing all right, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm all right, too. And for the first time, fellow podcaster Joseph Weigel from the Men with Chests podcast. Good to have you, Joseph. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Great. Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for coming on the show. So here's my question to all of you, just to kind of get us started. This book deals a good deal with fear and with phobias, particularly with Eustace Scrubb's phobia of heights at the beginning, which despite his fear of heights, he gets pushed off a cliff anyway. And with Jill's fear of being deep underground, a kind of a claustrophobia, or if there's some other phobia related to being not only in a tight space, but like deep underground, she seems to have it. So I'd be interested in hearing which most corresponds to your own fears. Are you more afraid of heights or are you more afraid of depths?
Well, I'm definitely afraid of heights. Yeah, like just pathetically so, which is ironic for a guy who comes from a fairly hilly part of the country and enjoys hiking through mountains. But yeah, like to be actually on a precipice is nerve-wracking for me, or a high bridge. Like I live in Michigan now, and you know, if you drive over the Mackinac Bridge up north, but that connects the Upper Peninsula of Michigan to the Lower Peninsula, which I've done a number of times, I find it nerve-wracking in the extreme. Definitely heights for me. And I feel like that's more unusual because one, you know, it's a sort of basic human thing is to like enjoy a prospect, mm-hmm. as the 18th century was so fond of calling it and talking about, you know, like to have a nice view, the high ground. It's always advantageous in a lot of ways and aesthetically pleasing usually. And so I find it, but I also find the immediate prospect of a precipice to be alarming. But you know, the underground thing too, I think, like the I find the second half of this book to be feeling, you know, it feels claustrophobic. It feels, I don't know if there's a word for it, but bathophobic, B-A-T-H-Y would be the Greek word for depth. So,
okay. Yeah.
Bathophobic. If you were down deep somewhere underground, like spelunking has never appealed to me either. So I could see how they're sort of mirrors of each other, the two extremes of this book.
Yeah. Yeah. I would much rather die by falling off a great height than by suffocating down in the depths of the earth. So for me, like, I'm more unreasonable when I would feel more panicky about
maybe that is the way to figure it out. How would you rather die?
Yeah.
Crushed to death, suffocated in the bowels of the earth, or falling from a horrifying height where you at least get a view, you know, you at least enjoy something of the splendor of creation before you meet your end.
Your life can flash before your eyes. All that sort of closure happens you know, before the splat. Eric, how about you?
It's always been, well, I haven't been in very many deep places, but it's always been heights for me. And I don't know why. I know that I feel it. When I get scared, I feel a tingling in my palms and sweaty and everything. And then, I try and stay away from high places as much as I can.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm no daredevil either with high places, but the depths are tougher for me. Joseph, what do you say?
Yeah, for me, it's the heights. And it's only when you get up to a certain point, like probably maybe like 4 or 5 floors, I'm okay. But then higher than that, I start to feel it big time. And with my job too, as a fireman, you have to do kind of a little bit of both, some height stuff and some more claustrophobic stuff. So I've had to kind of figure out how to be able to control the height stuff when you're doing something like, say, rappelling or something like that. But for the most part, it's not those extreme heights, you know, it's within that like 4 or 5 floors. And I've had to kind of figure out how to be okay with that. But when you start getting way up to those big time heights, like if I was out on, I think I went to St. Louis and like in the arch, and like you're standing out looking, you know, in the arch, I'm like, oh man, I don't really care for that.
Yeah. You know, I will say I totally hear you. I'm the same way, but there was a time last summer I was in Massachusetts visiting family, and I had my sons with me. They're young, and we went to, there's a World War II submarine that you can go down inside. It's docked down in Fall River. There's a big naval museum there. And so we went down into this World War II submarine, and so, you know, smaller than even they are now. And I was down there for maybe like the first 5 minutes or so was fine, but you can only like go through it in one direction, and it's kind of walled off. So it's actually even more enclosed than it would actually have felt for the sailors on it. But it's, at some point, like some switch flipped in my head and I freaked out, and I was just like, how do I get out of this thing? Like, what if somehow in the one moment that I'm down here with my family, like the thing just starts springing a leak and we all start drowning. Like, how do I get out of here? It was just this totally irrational fear that completely took over. I felt completely submerged and claustrophobic. I mean, obviously we weren't really submerged. The submarine is like surfaced in the harbor there. There's virtually no danger whatsoever, but it was just overwhelming. And it felt like we were very deep down and in this tiny enclosed place where there was only one direction we could travel in, and it wasn't entirely clear how long we would have to travel in that direction before we could come into the open air again. And yeah, it was, my kids were unfazed by it. They had no conception of danger down there. But of course, for them, it feels much bigger. I was profoundly uncomfortable. I mean, I would have been more freaked out if I'd been up in like a army helicopter or something, looking out the back where they parachute or something, where I guess airplane, but still, it is amazing how these two feelings are actually very complementary, just like they are in physical reality. Like they're these feelings of helplessness, I guess, like mm-hmm. you're out of your element, you're out of the human world, and you've entered a stratum of the universe that isn't really yours by rights.
So saying hi slightly late to my own dear wife, Glencora, you missed the intro question that we all kind of answered, which was this: are you more afraid of heights like Eustace, or of depths like Jill?
Oh, what do you think?
I think you're more afraid of heights.
Oh, 100%.
But I could be wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Every time I like come down the stairs with Arthur, that's our baby, I'm like, I'm going to die. I'm going to drop the baby. I'm going to die. So yeah, heights 100%.
So listeners, we're here to talk about the fourth book in C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, The Silver Chair. Just as The Voyage of the Dawn Treader is a kind of concentrated retelling of the best parts of medieval and ancient sea stories, so The Silver Chair is a mine for distilled medieval romances, albeit with the odd marsh wiggle thrown in. Longtime listeners of the show will be unsurprised to hear that its weirdness and humor, and honestly, like reading it again, its unevenness kind of weirdly makes it one of my favorite of the Narnia books, if not the favorite, at least for now. I love the vastness of the underground realms here, and the way they feel dangerous and eerie. In a way, honestly, that's like a little bit reminiscent, if that's a word I can make up, of Charn. The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, lots of people's favorite book, and I understand why, and I'm kind of there too. But this one, I think for my money, has an oddness to it that I really enjoy. Last time we talked a little bit about whether The Silver Chair is a fitting name for the book. I've since come across a letter from Lewis to Roger Lancelin Green about this, where he's trying to find a good name for it. So apparently he wasn't terribly settled on the Silver Chair, as it's kind of the way he was with a lot of his books. He wasn't sure what to name them. He says to Roger Lancelin Green, "Bless, like you, thinks the wild wastelands bad." But he says, "Night under Narnia is gloomy. George Sayer and my brother say gnomes under Narnia would be equally gloomy, but news under Narnia would do. On the other hand, my brother and the American writer Joy Davidman, who has been staying with us and is a great reader of fantasy and children's books, both say that The Wild Wastelands is a splendid title. What's a chap to do?" So that's...
I kind of like gnomes under Narnia.
I like it too.
That's a great name.
That would be kind of... I think I'd like knights under Narnia, but I don't know which one I would pick.
When was Under the Volcano published? Was that already taken? I mean, of course, there's no copyright on titles, so you know, you could do whatever you want. That would have been like the most literal title I could think of. Maybe it gives away too much. Malcolm Lowry. I just looked it up. It's 1947.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, it's a famous book. It's just about like an Englishman in the Latin America in like the 30s, I guess. The title is odd, but so in the thing you read just now, Chris, was there anything to indicate how he actually settled on this title, on The Silver Chair?
Nope.
We have no. We know things he rejected, but we don't have a record of how he arrived at The Silver Chair.
He had friends, some of his more offbeat friends like Owen Barfield and Charles Williams, who had written books with names like The Silver Stair and The Silver Trumpet, but maybe there's just something about silver that he was like, ooh, silver. Okay, so talking about heights and depths, I was listening to Michael Ward's Planet Narnia thing, because it's just a really thoughtful examination of all of the seven books. And one of the points that he makes is that it's sort of, the book is V-shaped, where you start up in England and then you get to Aslan's country and then you go down to Narnia, and then from Narnia you go down again to Underland, and from Underland you have the prospect of Bism, and then you go and you don't take that, but then you go up again to Narnia and then up again to Aslan's country. So there really is a kind of, and then of course to England, but there really is a kind of shape to the journey in terms of heights and depths, and both of the children's fears really play in, you know, come into play in this book of those things, of heights and of depths. Would anyone like to, we got it last time as far as chapter 7. Would anyone like to give like a quick summary of like what's basically happened so far between Eustace and Jill and Puddleglum?
Well, the basic plot of the thing is the search for a missing heir. It's to find the heir to the Narnian throne who's gone missing in an effort to search for his mother. What is it, right?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Prince Rillian disappeared in Narnian time. I forget how many years prior, like 10 or something. But
10. It's 10.
It's 10, yeah. And so Aslan, in rescuing Jill and Eustace, well, Jill particularly, I think, from bullying at an absurd English school, gives them the task of finding the absconded prince, and that's what leads them to the north, the northern wastelands of the Narnian continent, and then eventually underground there. And as you were saying earlier, it has a lot of medieval elements to it, especially. I hadn't thought of that V shape. That's actually really interesting because they do. Well, it's there's some question, I suppose, of where the real world, where England is in relation to or Aslan's country. So maybe the frame story there would be harder to factor in. But certainly from the point of view of the Narnian cosmos, it's that descent and ascent. So it reminds one a little bit of Dante, except that with Dante, you're going to go up a lot more than you go down, ultimately. But also of like a medieval, I mean, the medievals loved these stories of purgatory and descents into hell and visions of hell. Really cheerful time in history. And it's there's a lot of literature that charts these kinds of things. They're not always as like geographically precise as the silver chair, but that basic shape, I feel like, is a very medieval thing. And Lewis was certainly thinking of all that kind of stuff when he was writing this. But the basic plot of the novel, or the structure really, is that the catabasis, the going down part, and of course, and so this is in classical literature too, which is why we have a fancy Greek word for it, is something that only happens in sort of the latter or the middle and latter part of the novel. And you have a pretty huge chunk of time before that happens when they are on the surface and dealing with that primary world from the point of view of Narnia anyway. And the thing about that I would just point out that's always struck me about this book is that it causes one to really wonder about the weirdness that there's this entire world underneath Narnia that like nobody on the surface knows about and cares about. It has no real bearing on their lives most of the time. And it's just, it's there, but it's there and there's stuff going on. And the human characters and the Narnians get like a glimpse of it, but it's vast. And it's really, it feels much bigger and or more layered than the kingdom of Narnia itself. And so I feel like we kind of get in the habit when we talk about these books of thinking of Narnia as like the land of enchantment. Narnia is just like a tiny corner of the land of enchantment, this cosmos. And it's tiny in comparison to other like surface level polities that you get more of, you know, in other books, but or regions, like geographical, ecological regions, it's tiny in comparison to. And we get that in The Silver Chair, with marsh wiggles and the northern wastes and all that. But then it's also tiny in comparison to like an entire universe that's underneath. So that's just kind of a fascinating thing to me. I think it's extremely important in fantasy to usually create that sense of like, oh, here's this one kingdom that's our focus, or this one place, this country, this people, whatever it is. But actually there's this whole huge world extending in all kinds of directions away from it that you're only going to get a glimpse of, if that. But you need to know that larger world is there with its own motivations and complexities and everything in order for the apparent focus of the fantasy, Narnia itself, Narnia proper, to feel like it's not just a fairly shallow product of whimsy.
Yeah. Yeah, and that ability to evoke is so important, right? Yeah, even the depths of time that Tolkien is able to evoke, right? In the in the Middle Earth books, and the
time is an element too. Not just geographical, but it gets but the geography is such a big part of how it works.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
This is the second in a row too, Don Treader, and then this where they hardly even go to Narnia itself.
Yes.
But most of the story takes place elsewhere.
Yeah. 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 It's really funny to me that, I mean, I think Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and Prince Caspian are good, and they're good introductions to Narnia. I think the other books in the series are fantastic. And what's odd about that is they're kind of away for most of those, they're not actually in Narnia. In fact, when they get back to Narnia in this, honestly, I'm a little more bored than I was with the other play. Yep. I'm like, oh yeah, so centaurs graze for a long time, and you know, where before, like when they were in Underland, I was like, ooh, Bizum, you know, this world even lower than the Underland, you know, and it's funny that Narnia almost is an idea, right, that they carry with them to these other places outside of the country Narnia, right?
Lewis was a huge fan of Edmund Spenser. Mm-hmm. And this is a lesson I think he learned best from The Faerie Queen, which is this huge sprawling poem full of digressive stories. The center of the fantasy world that is the where a fairyland where the Fairy Queen occurs is the place where the Fairy Queen Gloriana lives. It's called Cosmopolis, allegorically, you know, it's London, and nobody ever goes to Cosmopolis in the Fairy Queen. People come from there, people, you know, everything has to do with Gloriana, but it's basically off the map. And that's because Spenser lived in Ireland. He never or rarely got to go to London, where he wanted to be. I mean, he wanted to be there seeking preferment rather than serving in the imperial frontier. But he didn't. And so the Fairy Queen is this incredible epic, this fantasy epic of the provinces, the peripheries, the fringes. And there's plenty of precedent for that. Spenser wasn't inventing that purely out of his own personal circumstances, but right. I don't think anyone's ever sort of capitalized on it to the degree Spenser was able to. And Lewis was, I can't think of a 20th century writer of any stripe who has more admired and been influenced by Edmund Spenser, the Elizabethan poet.
Yeah.
And so if anyone's looking for a literary pedigree to not just the Silver Chair, but as you were pointing out, Joseph, and you know, like, most of the books in Narnia happening on the fringes of Narnia or completely outside of Narnia itself, I'd say that's definitely the model he's drawing on.
That's a great connection. Generally, medieval romances that Fairy Queen draws its imagery from, which came to England mainly through French and like Southern influences. So tales of knights and chivalry, fairy mistresses. There's kind of a retelling here of the Greek Orpheus myth, but Eric had a really sound point that this is actually not just influenced by these sorts of Southern legends, right? And continental European legends, but also this is Lewis's most Northern Narnia book. And I wanted to make sure to have him share it. So Eric, can you talk about your idea here?
Yeah, sure. Well, like you said, Lewis did love medieval stories and classical Greek and Roman myths, but he also talked about a love of northernness. That's kind of what started his whole journey with Zenzukt or Sweet Desire. When he said northernness, he meant Norse and Icelandic sagas. Unlike Tolkien, who drew nearly all his inspiration from those sources, Lewis didn't seem to do much of it in most of the Narnia books. I believe the Silver Chair is where he lets his love of Norse mythology come through most. The characters spend, as has been said, nearly the whole book in the north of the world rather than just Narnia. They go to a city and castle of giants, like Thor and Loki's journey to Utgard. They go into the underworld to save Rillian, like the gods do to save Baldur. Father Time in the second half of the book is not a gnome, but the greatest of the giants, who has a noble and beautiful face. And in the last battle, it's he who destroys the sun. Also, I noticed something when I was going through this last time. Lewis describes the giant king's nose as straight and eagle-like. And he could have chosen like any word, like beak-like, bird-like, but he said eagle. And again, in Norse mythology, giants have the power to turn into eagles. So I know there are so many other influences and underworld stories playing a part in this, but yeah, that's my takeaway and my theory.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. And I think it would be a mistake to, in light of like kind of the southern influences, to forget about the northern things, because that's absolutely something that he loved. And they are going north, and this is his chance to put things like giants in the story. And I think too, the journey to the underworld, it is good to remember that that's not just in Greek and Roman myth, but it's in the story of Baldur as well. And they are going down to rescue a prince, right? And to rescue someone who will make Narnia a good place again, or the way it should be again. Unlike in the story of Baldur, of course, it actually works.
Yeah.
One other thing I wanted to ask you all before we, you know, talk about the chapters themselves. We've talked about this with the Voyage of the Non-Treader. We've talked about this a lot with Prince Caspian as well the year before. But when I think about Narnia, it's really hard not to think about C.S. Lewis's views on education, on the education of children, or of Narnia as a realm that kind of corrects modern educational deficiencies. What sort of education is Jill getting in the Silver Chair? And then we could throw Eustace in there too, but you know, they're rescued from this terrible school experiment house to receive a proper Narnian education. Is there something about what happens to them in Narnia that corrects the type of, you know, poor education they're getting in an experiment house? Or am I grasping at straws here?
I don't think you're grasping at straws at all. Yeah, I think it's they're reading the old books, essentially enlivening the imagination once again, but not just the imagination. They're also tying what they're experiencing into things like objective goodness and truth. The section that we're going to be reading here, so much of what we're talking about is that kind of allegory of the cave thing, and you know, oh, that's not actually true. That doesn't actually exist in reality. And that's the witches, you know, trying to deceive. And Lewis, he was no fan of all these progressive things happening with education. He saw them as being, you know, retrogressive. He thought that, you know, we should have the training in the same things that had been passed down going back to Plato and Aristotle, you know, the way he phrased it in Abolition of Man. So I think they're receiving that education in the story, and they're getting it in a very, you know, hands-on fashion.
There's also, maybe we could talk about this a little later, or maybe now. I never thought about it until just now, but I guess Puddleglum could be like a mentor kind of thing, because he's not only teaching them like, okay, you have to light the fire this way, and you have to, but he is the one who's the steadiest on the signs and the steadiest on, okay, we've got to get under the ruined city. And then when they are under it, he's like, they're both like, oh no, what's going to happen to us? And he's like, well, the important thing is we're following the instructions. We're doing what Aslan wants, and that comforts them.
Yeah. One of the things about Experiment House, if I remember, is it's like student-led, right? There aren't mentors. There aren't, the adults basically relinquish their responsibility to mentor and bring up the young people in their charge. And that contrasts pretty sharply with, if you think of this as an education, I hadn't thought of it that way before, but no. But then thinking of Dante with the going down and coming back up and all that, you know, he has to have a guide in every part of his journey. It's Virgil for almost 2/3 of it. And then there's a handoff in the terrestrial paradise at the top of Purgatory where Virgil can't guide him anymore and has to turn him over to Beatrice, but he has to have a guide at every point. And you certainly see that in like Tolkien stuff too, you know, like Gandalf or other figures, maybe at different times. It's a very strong trope in these quest stories that there are, and there's medieval versions of this, of course, that there's a bit of a hierarchy or there's an educational process that these quests sort of embody or concretize geographically. And that means that there's a guide, there's somebody, there's always some sort of person that the questors need to be paying attention to. There can be multiple levels of it. So, I mean, Aslan, of course, is sort of at the top. And again, in Dante, there's like, I forget the exact chain of command, how it works. It's like the Blessed Virgin tells Saint Lucia to tell Beatrice to go tell Virgil to help Dante, right? I think that's how it happens. You can have different levels of mentoring, but the point is you have like a kind of chain of command. And Puddleglum, I love the idea of Puddleglum as like sort of unwitting and somewhat unwilling mentor and guide among others in this one.
Yeah, yeah. And he's actually, I mean, you could say he's unwilling because he's tends to look on anything. He's a pessimist, right? At least philosophically he's a pessimist, but he's also excited to come along because it will teach him not to take a more serious view of things, right? Because
he is himself a student. It's right. Yeah. He recognizes that. He has one of the virtues, maybe, or the upshot of some of his pessimism is that it gives him a kind of humility, at least some of the time, that could be emulated by others.
Yeah. Including same. Well, so they meet this strange marsh wiggle, Puddleglum. They get going on their journey. They meet on the way the Lady of the Green Kirtle and a knight all in black who does not open his visor. They don't see his face and he never speaks. The Lady of the Green Kirtle says, you know, why don't you go, you know, it's really cold. Why don't you go to this place called Harfang where you have like properly civilized giants who will put you up and just tell them that I sent you for the autumn feast. And so off they go. They are thinking about how nice it's going to be out of the cold, cold weather. And finally in a bed, they stop thinking as much about the signs that Aslan has given them. These four signs that they're supposed to keep in mind, that Jill particularly is supposed to keep in mind and memorize. And does anyone remember, by the way, what the signs were? Let's have an Inklings Hour pop quiz. What are the four signs?
First one, Eustace will see an old friend, Aspian, and he needs to speak to him at once so that they can get help. They need to go to the ruined city of Giant and look under it. And the person they're looking for, the prince, will be the one who asks them to do something in Aslan's name. I can't remember what the other one is.
I always do exactly what you've just done, Eric, and like collapse the second and third signs, right? Because it's like you go to the ruined city of the giants and then you do what...
Oh, yeah. With
like,
what
the writing on the ruined city of the giants tells you to or something like that. And then you respond to the first person who uses the name of Aslan. They're odd. They're strange, and they seem arbitrary. And slowly, Jill sort of decides, I'd rather be thinking about the House of Harfang and how nice it's going to be to get there. They get there, as you read at the top. Puddleglum at first says, "No, we really shouldn't go," but the children get really angry at him, and so he goes along with what they want. They get to the House of Harfang. They announce that they are there for the Autumn Feast, and Jill has a dream of Aslan, in which he takes her to the window and shows her writing on the ruined city that they've made their way through. And the writing says, "Under me." And she says, "Oh, shoot," or something like that. She actually wakes up and sees that this isn't just a dream. The city actually does literally have words on it that say, "Under me," carved by these ancient giants. And they've messed up yet another of the signs, which was to do the thing that the writing tells them to do, and they haven't done that. Eventually,
wait.
How do they
under me? What is that like? How do you do that?
How do you under someone?
I'm sorry. I'm like, I'm a stand-in for all your stupid listeners. Well.
I don't know if you're looking for a place to go to find the prince, right? And you're supposed to do what writing says. You see writing that says "under me." Wouldn't you think to like go underneath the?
Okay. Yeah, maybe not.
But go ahead, Jonathan.
Well, they actually have to like run around in the trenches of the letters, right?
Yeah.
And you would like, I don't know, expect the characters to get that too, but of course they don't. They're strangely oblivious to.
Man,
to
the, there's so much they're oblivious to in yeah. these chapters. It's just so much.
I love anyway, how, yeah.
They do get underground there. That is the point where they end up getting into this underworld. A rather harrowing and bizarre circumstance where they're actually running around inside the letters that are trenches in the ground, right?
Mm-hmm.
Remembering that correctly. And
yep.
But it takes them a bit, again, to figure out that that's what they're doing. And before they realize where they are in the letters or the words. And then once they figure that out, they're able to go where they need to go, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Glencora, what were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say, I love the comedy of the giant, kind of the whole scene of them being at the giant. Like, it's just kind of obviously it's like frightening, but the irony is there. So it's just really comedic in some ways, you know, like they discover that they're going to be eaten by reading a book, like a recipe book. And they're being dressed like dolls. I mean, it just feels, I don't know. I just really enjoy that sort of irony.
Yeah, it's super fun. I mean, he makes it a lot of fun to read about. And there's a real, you know, I mean, it borders on dramatic irony, right? The way that there are so many things, starting with that E that they lose themselves in on the way up to Harfang, and they have no idea where it is, they have no idea that this is the message about what they need to do, and they're just kind of like, oh, it's nicer down here, it's not as windy, but we can't get anywhere. And then it's this moment that Lewis likes to create, and we talked about this a little bit last time. He does a lot in Out of the Silent Planet where you experience something first and then you find out what it is. Like, you know, experiencing, seeing this tiny blue, you know, dot and then realizing that it's Earth, right? Or experiencing different characteristics of these planets that he takes us to in the Ransom trilogy, and then realizing, oh, this was Mars I've been on this whole time. So there's this sort of cascading series of epiphanies that they get, right? There's this one that they have, and I'll read a little bit of this passage where she's having this dream of Aslan. The rain fell steadily all that evening and all the night, dashing against the windows of the castle, and Jill never heard it, but slept deeply past supper time and past midnight. This is after they've gone to Harfang. And then came the deadest hour of the night, and nothing stirred but mice in the house of the giants. At that hour, there came to Jill a dream. It seemed to her that she awoke in the same room and saw the fire sunk low and red, and the firelight, the great wooden horse. And the horse came of its own will, rolling on its wheels across the carpet, because, of course, they put lots of toys in her room, because the giants see her not only as potential food, but also as a child, because she's small, and stood on her head. And now it was no longer a horse, but a lion as big as the horse. And then it was not a toy lion, but a real lion, the real lion, just as she had seen him on the mountain beyond the world's end. And a smell of all sweet-smelling things there are filled the room. But there was some trouble in Jill's mind, though she could not think what it was, and the tears streamed down her face and wet the pillow. The lion told her to repeat the signs, and she found that she had forgotten them all. At that, a great horror came over her, and Aslan took her up in his jaws. She could feel his lips and his breath, but not his teeth, and carried her to the window and made her look out. The moon shone bright, and written in great letters across the world or the sky, she did not know which, were the words, "Under me." After that, the dream faded away. When she woke very late the next morning, she did not remember she had dreamed at all. She was up and dressed, and had finished breakfast in front of the fire when the nurse opened the door and said, "Here's a pretty poppet's little friends come to play with her." In came Scrub and the Marshwiggle. "Hello, good morning," said Jill. "Isn't this fun? I've slept about 15 hours, I believe. I do feel better, don't you?" "I do," said Scrub, "but Puddleglum says he has a headache." "Hello, your window has a window seat. If we got up on that, we could see out." And at once they all did so. And at the first glance, Jill said, "Oh, how perfectly dreadful." And of course, they see that the letters under me in the dream are not just a dream. So there's this moment in which Aslan actually has to come in the form of a dream and interfere, because they've been thrown so off course by this desire to kind of have things their way in the middle of the quest. Right. And maybe it's Lent talking here, but I think this sort of infantilizing of Eustace and Jill especially is kind of an extension of them wanting to be catered to, right? Of them wanting, of them kind of refusing the rigor and virtue that it's going to take to complete their quest. You get all these comforts, but you've lost agency and the ability to do something good. And then, of course, having lost agency, you're led away to be devoured. And you see this kind of dynamic at work, like in lots of other works of literature, right? The Morlocks and the Eloy and the Time Machine, Pleasure Island in Pinocchio, even though they don't eat the donkeys, they just put them to work. But Aslan comes in and forcibly puts a stop to this.
Something interesting with the dream stuff is that this is a theme that comes up in Lewis in multiple places. And I think he thinks that there can actually be communication from God, or in this case, Aslan, you know, Maleldil, whatever the title is, to humans. And that's probably a pretty unpopular idea for most Christians today. But from what I can tell from looking at what Lewis says, that I think he's at least open to this idea that, oh no, God can actually communicate to us in our dreams. And we shouldn't just shut that idea out as saying, no, there's no way that that can happen. I don't think he wants to be gullible and just say, oh, you accept anything in a dream and take it, oh, this is a sign. No, he's not like that. But he does want to have the door open and say, we shouldn't simply deny dreams as being, you know, maybe truly that Freudian analysis. You know, he wants to say that there can be some sort of supernatural communication via those. At least that's the impression I get from reading them. I'd be curious if you guys think the same, or if there's something different there.
Well, I think it's a good point. I mean, this is again something he's drawing heavily from medieval literature. The medievals were absolutely obsessed with dreams. it's all over the place. The dream vision is like just one of the stock and trades of the medieval writers for hundreds of years. So he's definitely drawing on that in like a literary sense. the question of whether he's trying to suggest that we really ought to pay more attention to dreams as a form of divine guidance is, you know, I mean, that to some extent, at least to me, I think depends on how seriously or sincerely we take the medieval authors, I think, that he was drawing on, because they tend, you know, it's if you teach creative writing, you'll know that one of the favorite things people do almost naturally, it seems like, is, you know, they'll tell some fantastical story and then they'll be like, and it was all a dream. And it's like, this is a primordial human impulse, apparently, is to like, if you feel like telling something crazy and then like just sort of shunt it off onto a dream to get it to go down more smoothly. And definitely, I think a lot of that was going on in the Middle Ages, but also they would have taken things like dreams differently than we tend to, like you say, sort of explaining them away in a Freudian way or a Jungian way, maybe more popular now. There are definitely people more interested now in like archetypal sort of interpretations, various symbolisms that people are trying to kind of resuscitate, and often in the context of dreams. And that is still, I think, a different thing from what you're talking about, Joseph, where the dream is not really being symbolic. It's more like just showing you the way, you know, and like you just have to be wise enough to wake up to it. It's so hard, isn't it, to talk about this without resorting to Freudian concept, like your unconscious or your subconscious. I mean, we just very easily throw these terms out as if they are like self-evident and make sense and are scientifically proven or something. Like your dream's trying to tell you something that you already know, you just don't know you know it. And so you have to regurgitate it to yourself in sleep. That seems to be maybe what's going on here. And they have noticed some things, but they haven't noticed that they've noticed them. And so they need to have a dream that's going to wake them up to what they have already, in fact, known, what they've already known, but they haven't realized yet. That's kind of what the dream is trying to get you to do. And I don't see any reason not to consider that kind of divine intrusion of sorts. It's an apocalypse, a pulling back of the veil of what you already have seen. You just haven't let yourself acknowledge that you've seen it. And I think, I mean, that seems to describe what actually happened in the story. It's an intrusion into conscious thought of unconscious knowledge.
Yeah. And once they realize that, and once they realize like, oh shoot, we literally missed the writing on the, you know, writing on the ground or the building or whatever, not on the wall this time, but you know, this paves the way for all sorts of other unpleasant discoveries. Like they're trying to figure out, okay, we need to pretend like we're really excited about this autumn feast, but we also need to be scheming about how to get out of here and go do what Aslan told us to do. And so they're, you know, going around eating with the giants, things like that. And Puddlegum suddenly tells them, okay, don't eat another bite of what we're eating right now, because the giants are talking about how the stag begged them not to shoot him. And they realize they've been eating a talking stag. How that doesn't help them realize that the giants are also planning on eating them, I'm not sure, because obviously, like, if giants are okay with eating other things that can reason and talk that look different from them, why wouldn't they be okay with eating humans and marsh wiggles? But sure enough, as they're planning to sneak out through the scullery, they discover a cookbook, and right under mallard, this delicious bird can be cooked in a variety of ways. They see, man, this elegant little biped has long been valued as a delicacy. It forms a traditional part of the autumn feast and is served between the fish and the joint. Each man, and, you know, presumably it goes on. And then under that, as if that's not bad enough, they also have marsh wiggle. Some authorities reject this animal altogether as unfit for giants' consumption because of its stringy consistency and muddy flavor. The flavor can, however, be greatly reduced if... So this great...
I'm sorry, that's... You know, that's really funny.
It's great.
Yeah,
it's so fun.
I mean, the point earlier, Glencora's point about like the comedic element in this is a really good one, you know. And it's like the most, it's in some ways it's sort of the most tense part of the story. Yeah. But it's also the place, as far as I recall, where it has the most sort of comedy and irony in it.
Yeah.
But yeah. Just to make one last point about the medievals, the whole business about them having their wits addled by comfort is super medieval and super Spencerian. I mean, it's like a whole book of the Fairy Queen. There's only six books in it. A whole book of it is about a guy who gets lured to a place called the Bower of Bliss. And his task is basically to destroy the Bower of Bliss because the, you know, good Elizabethan sort of proto-Puritan that Spencer was, you know, all this like worldly comfort is definitely not going to turn out well. And he's just inheriting that straight from the Middle Ages. There is a lot of merriment and feasting and whatnot. It's true in medieval culture, but like there's also a ton of asceticism and emphasis on virtue and self-discipline, and somehow we tend to like overlook all of that, but it's really the dominant theme in most stages of sort of Christian civilization. And yeah, the idea that like comfort is going to screw up your ability to think straight. There's just no two ways about it. You're going to miss important signs. You're going to go for the easy route whenever you can. This is an insight about human nature that Lewis's inspirations understood very well. And that's definitely coming across strong in this part. And it's an opportunity to make fun of people and to have some comedy, because it is downright funny how abjectly and pathetically and stupidly we mess up when we're chasing after the most immediately comforting kinds of things that we can get.
It's really hard not to see the whole cannibal thing coming, right? They're giants, which have been known to eat people.
Yeah.
And they're going to the giant's house and saying, she wants you to have us for your autumn feast, right? Yeah. Like, I wonder if he's just kind of trying to get even the kids, you know, who are reading it to anticipate this twist that's going to happen. But it's also such a, like, discovering the cookbook of the people who have been treating you really nicely and discovering that you are there as a potential meal in the cookbook has been done a lot in the 20th century since this. So, like, I thought immediately of the Treehouse of Horror episode.
Let me get this straight. You thought they thought we were going to eat them. Good God. Is this some kind of joke?
No, they're serious.
Well, why were you trying to make us eat all the time?
Make you eat? We merely provided a sumptuous banquet. And frankly, you people made pigs of yourselves.
I slaved in the kitchen for days for you people.
Well, if you wanted to make Serac the Preparer cry, mission accomplished.
You aren't the only beings who have emotions, you know.
And also the Twilight Zone episode, To Serve Man, which it's based, right? Where aliens only want to serve man, and they throw down this book saying, like, this will explain everything.
This is our Bible, right? Right.
Yeah,
this
so
is
the linguist, like,
who we live by.
You know, they're carting all these people away off of Earth to go to this wonderful alien land, and the linguists, you know, is just like, well, they seem really great and everybody's pretty happy with them, but I'll just work on, you know, deciphering this book that they left. And then gradually she realizes that To Serve Man is actually a cook, you know, and she like yells to her boss before he gets on the rocket ship, it's a cookbook.
Mr. Chambers, don't get on that ship. The rest of the book, To Serve Man, it's a cookbook.
No!
Astonishingly, their language has the exact same pun in it as English.
That's right. Really, that's right. As difficult as it was to crack, surprisingly, there's some. There's some similarities. Is anybody aware of something like this before this? Like, could the Silver Chair have somehow influenced the Twilight Zone writer who influenced the Simpsons? Or is there some earlier example of a cookbook of someone who's trying to eat you that anybody can think of?
Jack and the Beanstalk, something. There isn't really a cookbook there, but
yeah,
Yeah, but it is, again, like another example of like they kind of should have known that the giants were planning on eating them.
I mean, it's a pretty, like, Montaigne has a huge essay on cannibals. I think it looms large in the European imagination from the beginning of the Age of Exploration, when they're encountering all kinds of New World peoples, many of whom would slaughter and eat their enemies, at least ritualistically, or like a little bit, not like feasting or, you know, subsisting primarily, but there is at least some, and it made a big impression on Europeans. I mean, yeah, I don't know. It's definitely in the imagination there. The actual trope of like a cookbook that gets interpreted or misinterpreted at first and then deciphered, I'm not aware of anything prior to that.
That's just like how ironic, you know, it's like, it's such a wild, it's a cannibalism is such a kind of a base thing to do, and how they have a cookbook for it, you know, like it, how it, it's so civilized.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of the central thing about these giants, right? Yeah. They're barbaric and yet civilized at the same time. It's
they're Europeans. They're So we were talking earlier about the education and Lewis's feelings about that. And yeah, he has no regard for this modernistic, whatever, progressive so-called education. But he also had no regard for sort of decadent, aristocratic and haute bourgeois culture of Europe in the 19th and early 20th century with its etiquette. And I mean, he was like famously a deliberately messy dresser, I think Lewis was. Yep. And, you know, from our vantage point, we see pictures of him and he's wearing a suit. So we're like, oh, he's all dressed up. But actually, by the standards of his time and place, you know, I think he dressed in a kind of froppy manner. Nowhere near as effete as he could well have done, given his position. And I think, yeah, it's a poke at the sort of dilapidated, decadent, overgrown mannerisms of upper class European culture over the entire sort of later modern period. He put no store in that kind of thing. I mean, he's just some kid from Northern Ireland. You know, he's from the boondocks. He's not some Parisian snob.
Yeah, I mean, I think this idea of this society as being decadent is probably pretty on the mark. And it's interesting that you've got Experiment House, of course, and then you have these two sort of dystopian places within Narnia, right? Both Harfang and, as we'll see pretty soon, Underland as being these places where something is wrong with society. Although Harfang, I don't even know if, I mean, does it count as cannibalism if it's a giant that does it? Is that?
Well, it still kind of is, because isn't Polyphemus from the Odyssey called that, or for eating Greeks, or?
I'm not sure if he is. He's definitely seen in a negative light for eating the Greeks, partly because he's so barbaric. But
Well, I think the key is the Hanau, if we use that word that mm-hmm. Lewis liked to use right. In the Ransom trilogy. It's not so much what species, you know, the DNA necessarily is, but is it now? Is it endowed with reason? And so that would be, I think, all encapsulated in cannibalism as Lewis is thinking about it.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that's well said. And I think, you know, certainly you can see that taboo at work with the humans in Narnia, right? That they feel awful when they find out they've been eating talking stag, right? And that maybe is something when you are setting down the laws for a society full of different types of people who are Achna, who have a common sort of reason. Right. One of those laws is like, maybe don't eat each other, you know, even if you kind of look like animals to the others. But yeah.
And Puddleglum, if I remember right, Puddleglum is repulsed when he finds out that they were eating the talking stag. Was he the initial guy to respond like that?
Yeah. So Jill's like, oh man, that stinks, poor Stag. And Eustace is, oh no, one of my best friends was a talking animal. This is terrible. I feel disgusted. And then Puddlegum is absolutely horrified because he's Narnian. And so he feels like he's eating a baby, it says.
Yeah. That just made me think of the education stuff that obviously comes up all the time with Lewis. And the basic idea, he says, of education is train the pupil to have the right responses, you know, to like what is likable and to feel disgust at what is disgusting, you know. And you see that with Puddleglum, and Puddleglum, as Eric mentioned earlier, being kind of that mentor. I think Lewis, that's a common theme as I see it in education, where he displays it in a good light. It always seems to be in that mentor model, kind of like the, you know, experience he had with Kirkpatrick. Maybe the best example of that is that Caspian with his older mentor. Then Puddleglum is that mentor in this story. So that seems to be Puddleglum. You can tell right there he had the right emotional response. And, you know, he is that mentor figure for Eustace and Jill in the story.
Yeah, that's great. And it does say that by the end, they kind of came around to his feeling about it, that they were also equally horrified. It just took some time. So that's very much to your point.
Yeah, well, they have to be educated, like you were saying earlier. I mean, this is the story of an education. And Jill, I mean, this is Jill's first time around, so she definitely needs to be educated. But Eustace also is not a native. So it's virtue ethics. They have to be, the virtue has to be instilled in them. And it's Aristotelian, you know, it's a thing you have to train. You can't rely on it to just manifest perfectly in a natural way.
Yeah, absolutely. This flight from the hunting giants, honestly, like, this is the most suspenseful part of the book for me, where she's running away, and Jill, especially because it's from her point of view, she's running away and she dives after Scrub and Puddlegum through a hole. It's just the pace is great. You know, the hunting party's coming back just as they're leaving. They have bright colors on, so they're easy to see, but they dive down in the hole and then fall down another hole, you know, just kind of skidding down and down and down until they get to Underland, and we have Travels Without the Sun. Jonathan, where can people find you and find your work?
Well, I'm on Slant Books, the publisher of my novel. You can find me on there. I post a blog for them fairly regularly. I do have a Substack. I might someday start writing again, jonathangeltner.substack. So
cool.
That works too. And I'm on Twitter if you want to read all my obnoxious tweets.
Nice.
And or whatever we call it now.
What is the name of your novel?
My novel, my realist novel, is Absolute Music by Slant Books. I also published a translation of Paul Claudel's poetry from Angelico Press, if anyone is interested in reading some great visionary religious poetry from the modernist period.
Awesome. We'll link to those in the show notes. And Joseph Weigel, thanks again for joining us for the first time. Hopefully it won't be the last. And where can people find you?
Yeah, well, my podcast is Men with Chests, so you can find that wherever you listen to podcasts, most likely. And then I do have an Instagram for the show. It's same thing, Men with Chests. Or actually, I think it's Men W Chests, because they didn't have the width available.
So, fair enough.
Men W Chests. Yeah, that's my Instagram, and that's where I put up, you know, new episodes and that kind of stuff.
Nice. All right, well, listeners, thank you so much for joining us. Gentlemen, thank you all so much. And my wife, Clancora, had to hop off. She was tired, as are we all. And yeah, much appreciated. I'll see you all next time.
All this encounter full of joy and scheduled on the decent plan, with here an addict of Tolkien, there a Charles Williams fan.
This is flight number 914 from Earth to our planet. We will be taking off in 3 minutes.
Mr. Chambers!
Mr. Chambers, don't get on that ship. The rest of the book, To Serve Men, it's a cookbook.
No! 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 No!
Not eaten enough, Mr. Chambers. Please, enjoy. Eat hearty. Please, Mr. Chambers, eat. We wouldn't want you to lose weight.
How about you? You still on Earth or on the ship with me? It really doesn't make very much difference because sooner or later, we'll all of us be on the menu. All of us.
Fucking right!
Humans, you have stopped eating.
Listen, you big, stupid space creature. Nobody, but nobody eats deception.
I beg your pardon.
Don't play dumb with me. We found your book.
You mean this? It's a harmless cookbook. It's just a little dusty.
Oh. Wait a minute.
Aha! Wait, there's still more space dust on here. Let me get this straight. You thought
they thought we were going to eat them.
Good God. Is this some kind of joke?
No. They're serious.
Well, why were you trying to make us eat all the time?
Make you eat? We merely provided a sumptuous banquet. And frankly, you people made pigs of yourselves.
I slaved in the kitchen for days for you people, and...
Well, if you wanted to make Serac the Preparer cry, mission accomplished.
You aren't the only beings who have emotions, you know.